she realized that it wasn't her job to save all the children of Burundi. That was God's job. Up to that point, she really had thought it was her job, and it was crushing her. And once she made the mental shift, which again, very much has to do with how she lives her faith, that this is not my job. I'll do what I can, but ultimately, God, this is your job. It's your responsibility. She was able to take all of the weight off of her own shoulders and put it on God, and that changed everything for her.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn and discover how speaking with people of other faiths can strengthen our own faith and even our own practice. Today on In Good Faith, we're sharing a story that shows both the beautiful and the terrible in life. And it's a story that unfolded over decades and still continues today. In the 1970s, there was a genocide in the African country of Burundi, which flared up again in the 1990s, hundreds of thousands of people killed by their neighbors. And through it all, an amazing woman named Maggie Barankitse found remarkable ways of blessing thousands of children orphaned in those conflicts. Maggie Barankitse is the founder of Maison Shalom, an NGO or non-governmental organization that began as a place to care for the orphans of genocide, the Burundi and Rwanda genocide specifically. Today, Maggie lives in exile in Rwanda after narrowly escaping an assassination attempt in 2015. Maison Shalom was declared an illegal organization in Burundi, and she was sentenced to life in prison by the Supreme Court of Burundi, convicted in absentia. She has re-established Maison Shalom in Rwanda. Maggie has received multiple humanitarian awards, including the Opus Prize, the UNESCO Prize, and the Aurora Prize. Maggie and her work inspired today's guest, David Toole, who shared her story in the book, Love Made Me an Inventor. He also talks about how his faith was strengthened by her example. David Toole is director of the Kenan Institute for Ethics at Duke University, where he holds a joint appointment as associate professor in the Duke Global Health Institute and Duke Divinity School. He's founder of Love's Inventions, a nonprofit dedicated to spreading a message of nonviolence to the world and supporting Maggie Barankitse's ongoing work in Africa.
So Maggie Barankitse is a woman from Burundi, now in her late 60s. I met her in 2009 in Burundi, where at the time she was the founder and was running a sizable organization called Maison Shalom, House of Peace, which she had started on the front end of the civil war in Burundi in 1993, 1994, after living through great trauma herself in the beginning of that war. She started an organization dedicated to caring for the orphans that were accruing in Burundi, both because of the war and because of those were peak years for HIV/AIDS. So she started with 32 children, seven of whom were her own adopted children, and then 25 that she collected after a massacre. And in a very short period of time, it turned into hundreds, and after hundreds became thousands and thousands. And that was true until 2015, when Burundi was going into political turmoil and there was an attempt on her life. Maison Shalom was declared an enemy of the state, and Maggie had to flee into exile, where she's been ever since, splitting her time between Luxembourg and Rwanda.
It's so interesting to think of a humanitarian organization feeding children to be described as an enemy of a state.
Yes.
She has received multiple humanitarian awards, including the Opus Prize, the UNESCO Prize, and the Aurora Prize. And I wonder if you could tell me, David, how you met Maggie.
At the time, I was working as an associate dean in Duke Divinity School, and the dean that I was working for asked me to be part of an interdisciplinary team at Duke that was going to Uganda to work with Ugandan universities and develop leadership and management trainings for workers in the health system in Uganda. And my role in that was largely because of the large number of faith-based and particularly Catholic organizations that run parts of the healthcare system. At the same time, the dean had just a couple of years before started the Center for Reconciliation as part of Duke Divinity School, and the founding co-directors of that center, one of whom was a Ugandan, had started a leadership workshop in East Africa geared toward Christian leaders in East Africa who are working in the trenches of reconciliation, either amid conflict or in the aftermath of conflict in countries like Burundi, Rwanda, Uganda, Eastern Congo. I mean, you pick your country in East Africa, they were all there. So this was January of 2009. I went to East Africa with sort of errands for both of those projects. I spent a week in Uganda and then went to Burundi, where this workshop was being held for Christian leaders on reconciliation. And so I was sitting in a conference hall in a hotel in Bujumbura, Burundi, first trip to Africa, when Maggie Berenkitsa walked into the room and told her story in about 30 minutes. She was not a pre-planned part of the conference. And if you hear Maggie's story, you want more. The thing that hooked me into wanting to tell her story over time. After the conference, she invited us to come out to Ruigi, her hometown, where she was doing all of the work and had been doing, or most of the work. So we made the trip to Ruigi in January 2009, and she took us to the hospital that at that time was just a year old. And when we were touring the hospital, it was still under construction. And in a typical sort of African fashion, at least in that part of Africa, hospitals aren't big sort of towering multi-story buildings, but they're single-story buildings connected by verandas and rockways sprawling across a landscape. So when we were touring the hospital, or even before when we could see it from a distance, she let us know that she'd built the hospital on the side of her family's village that had been destroyed in the fall of 93 when the country blew up because of the assassination of the democratically elected Hutu president by faction of the Tutsi military. Maggie's a Tutsi a couple days after the assassination of the Hutu president. Hutus were running rampant around the country, destroying things. And so Maggie's village was destroyed. More than 60 members of her family died. And then it was 2 days later that she lived through her own trauma, where she was forced to watch 72 people die. And so here we are in 2009, we're touring a hospital, which is built on the side of the village. And she points out one of the buildings, which is the morgue, which had a very prominent place on the campus. And started narrating the morgue with a kind of pride that I didn't understand. I've been to lots of hospitals in America, and you can't find the morgue because it's in the basement and we don't talk about it. But for Maggie, the morgue was this essential feature of the hospital, a hospital that was built upon the site of a massacred village. And I didn't really understand then, and this was what kept me coming back to Maggie for the first few years, was what does it mean to build a hospital where the most important part of the hospital is the morgue? Like, what is that about? She actually told us that when we were there in 2009, but I didn't have a brain to process it. What I heard then, and then ultimately was able to process over time, was that in Burundi in the 90s, when the war was at its peak, bodies had just become corpses. As you mentioned, there's roughly 300,000 people died in over 12 years. And they reached a point where you just don't pay attention anymore. So the bodies were in the street and you step over them. Or even the bishop early on, when she got to hundreds of children and didn't have any place to house them, he gave her an old school that had been abandoned. One of the first things they had to do was clean the bodies out of the school because it just became a place to throw bodies, right? So Burundians were spending no time caring for the dead, and Maggie was trying to actually care for the living. And what she explained is she learned, like, if you want to care for the living, you first have to care for the dead. Because once you have no ability to care for the dead, which is what had happened, you're never going to get to caring for the living. So the morgue, counterintuitively for us in America, the way we build hospitals, the morgue was the essential part of the hospital, because that's where they care for the dead. And as long as she could get that up and running and teach families to care for the dead, then she felt like she had a hope of doing what she really wanted to do, was to care for the living and get the living to care for one another. And that was the sort of mystery to me that kept me coming back to Maggie for the first couple of years, is what I need to understand what you're saying, because it just didn't compute. It didn't make sense.
You refer to Maggie as a biblical figure. And I think I have to agree, from just what I've learned so far in the book, someone who went, like Job in a way, to lose everything and then to start adopting hundreds of children that became her own. And this is in the backdrop of 300 or so thousand people being killed, creating twice that many orphans, is just a staggering scale.
obviously, I wrote about that and wrote that line in the book where I say something to the effect that she's not only always referring to biblical figures and putting her context in the life of biblical figures, but that she is one. And so there's a sense in which it's very easy to say that Maggie is like Esther, which is something not that Maggie says of herself, but that others have said of Maggie when she had to flee Burundi into exile in Rwanda. She didn't really want to leave Burundi, but she did. And in the course of that, other people gave her sort of two ascriptions of biblical figures. They called her Joseph and really convinced her to leave Burundi by saying, you'll be like Joseph. You're going to leave your own country, go to a strange place, but there's a purpose behind this, and that's how you're going to save your people. Which then people started comparing her to Esther because, of course, Esther also plays a role in saving her own people. And Maggie is very, very much like both, very much like Esther in particular, because not only did she end up in Rwanda after fleeing Burundi, where with tens of thousands of Burundians who needed help, and in a sense, suddenly Maggie was there to help them. But part of the things that led to her exile from Burundi were the way in which she started taking on the government. Early seed of the conflict she had with the government was a meeting with the president of Burundi where she told him, in this case, actually, because of something she read, and this is where she becomes Jonah, she told him that he was like the king of Nineveh and needed to change his ways or Burundi was going to fall back into violence. It's very easy to say she's like these figures, but then you start to realize that, but she sort of is these figures, right? I mean, that she literally challenges a president and says, change your ways. She literally flees a country and ends up in a strange place. And then, as she would say and does say, God clearly intended that so that I could save my people. You know, for her, the Joseph story was the mistake that led to the salvation of the Jewish people. And she sees her own life very much that way, that my exile is a mistake that the president of Burundi made so that I am now here saving my people in Rwanda. So I think you just get rid of the like and you just say she's a biblical character. She just is a biblical character.
Well, a little insight. Would you mind telling the story of the bishop's curtains? Because this gives a little insight into personality in just a few paragraphs.
So the story of the curtains is it's early in the time of her sort of collecting Burundian orphans. I guess you could say she's had a year in to accruing hundreds of orphans. It's a Burundian Christmas tradition that when Christmas comes, children get new clothes. She had probably about 700 children at this time that she was taking care of. Many of them were teenagers, but about 200 of them were young children who really did need new clothes. So she went to the bishop and asked him if he would provide her some funds to buy new clothes for these 200 children. He said, no, I can't. The diocese just simply doesn't have the money. Maggie knew that the bishop had just put new curtains in his residence, and in particular in the great hall where he entertained his guests. So she snuck into the residence, stole the curtains, took them all down, and took them to seamstress friends. They sewed clothes for the 200 children out of the curtains. At Christmas Mass, the children came to Mass dressed in the bishop's curtains. The bishop was presiding. He didn't notice that they were dressed in his curtains. Then his name was Joseph, and St. Joseph was his patron saint. So I think the celebration of that is March 19th. And so there was a celebration of the feast day for St. Joseph. The bishop was celebrating. He invited Maggie to come to the celebration. She said, I'd love to come, but only if I can bring my children. So she shows up with a couple hundred children dressed in the bishop's curtains in the great hall where the curtains used to be, at which point one of the nuns who was working in the diocese noticed that the children were dressed in things that looked an awful lot like the bishop's curtains. And she turned to point out the comparison between the curtains and the children, and then noticed at that point that there were no curtains, and immediately realized what happened, chastised Maggie, got very angry at Maggie for stealing the bishop's curtains. The bishop called her in and said, Maggie, you've stolen my curtains. And he said, no, bishop, I asked you to provide clothes at Christmas for the children, and you did. And she said, you still have curtains, because of course there was the kind of lightweight, opaque under curtain that's still on the windows. Like, she just refuses to be deterred by someone saying, no, you can't do that, or that won't work.
We hear about people speaking truth to power, and that's always a fraught activity. But especially, as you mentioned, speaking to the president of a country that's really under military rule, it's downright dangerous. As you mentioned, she had to flee and attempt on her life. How do you reflect, sitting here in relative comfort, as we are discussing this, about the people who are motivated, like Maggie, to actually just drop everything to do this mission they feel called to do?
This is really where her faith comes in, but and I've, of course, pressed her a lot on this over the years. What you realize about her faith is that first of all, it's not something abstract, and it started for her very young. She grew up in a Catholic family. Her father died very young, so she was raised by her mother alone. And every morning, her mother took her, it was just she and her one brother, they went to Mass every morning. After Mass, they would go visit the prisons and feed prisoners. And this was a daily thing. And Maggie will tell you that, I mean, she is who she is because of her mother. From a very, very young age, she really learned to embody faith. One of the interesting parts of that, though, and I think this is what makes her such a fascinating figure when you're really thinking about the motivating factors of these things, is that doesn't mean that she has any kind of blind or unexamined following of God. When in 1972, there was a genocide in Burundi that preceded the one in 1993, 1994, and after, maybe 250,000 Burundians died, mostly Hutu. And Maggie was 16 years old and in high school at the time. And suddenly you have Hutu classmates coming to school who didn't know what had happened to their fathers because their fathers had been killed. And you had Hutu teachers, Maggie's a Tutsi, you had Hutu teachers who suddenly disappeared. And this was a Catholic school. And the school was doing nothing to acknowledge that, in fact, all these people were disappearing because they were being killed in a genocide. And so Maggie went home to her mother and said, "You've lied to me. That I thought we were all one human family and that God was love. And clearly all that's a lie because this is happening and the church is saying nothing, doing nothing." That was when she was 16 years old. And that kind of deep sense of, I don't know if you just want to say justice or this deep sense of how the world is supposed to work, if in fact it's true that we're all one human family and we're all God's creatures and we're all, as she likes to say over and over again, princes and princesses. If that's true, and she was led to believe it was true, then when that's not happening, you get angry, you scream and yell, both at the people who lied to you, but also ultimately Maggie screamed and still screams sometimes and yells at God, because if in fact you are who you say you are, then why is this now happening? Not just to me, to my people, but nowhere in there does she give up her faith, right? She hangs in with it and it becomes the motivating factor. I mean, she has said more than once, and I've heard her say on public occasions, that were it not for her faith, she would have committed suicide because of the trauma that she lived through. Like, it's never a doubt that God exists. It's just a freedom in the face of the difficulties of a life to call God to account. And she's made a life of that. I mean, she still does it. She's not completely, I mean, as I say somewhere in the book, she still believes that God owes her, that he has a debt with me, she will say. And yet she's got to be the most faithful person I've ever met. She holds all that together.
This is In Good Faith. We're speaking with David Toole about refugee and humanitarian Maggie Baranketse, the subject of his book, Love Made Me an Inventor. You can hear more stories of survivors in Episode 8, a conversation with Mariama Colon Oleyemi about the civil war in Sierra Leone, Episode 129, where I talked to Leonard Bagalwa about his experience in the Congo, and Episode 173 about the Latter-day Saint experience in Turkey. Find all our episodes on Apple, Spotify, and YouTube. And please share an episode that's meant something to you with the people in your life.
Hi, I'm Stephen Cap Perry, host of In Good Faith. Nothing captivates me more than people setting out on an adventure, especially if it's a place I wish I could go to or a subject I wish I knew more about, but I don't live in the right place or I don't have the equipment or the expertise. I'm telling you about a podcast from our BYU Radio family of podcasts, an award-winning podcast called Constant Wonder. With host Marcus Smith, you'll be expanding your horizons on all kinds of discovery. It could be science, it could be art, history, and more. Do you need that feeling of awe and wonder in your life more? I do, and I love it when I see how to experience that by hearing the stories of people who are doing and exploring all of those things that are so interesting to me. Check out the podcast, Constant Wonder.
More from David Toole from Duke Divinity School. Really, I wanted to ask about how people have different reactions to something as awful as what happened there. I wonder, it seems that she didn't just change overnight. But in moments of despair, she goes to a convent and starts this process. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
The trauma she lived through was the fall of 93. She created Mizon Shalom formally in the spring of 94. By the fall of 94, she had hundreds of children, and then it grew from there. And for about the first 4 years, she was just running herself ragged, trying to continue to care for all of the children who were ending up in her doorstep, which she became known as the woman who took children who didn't have anywhere else to go. And by the time you get to the spring of 94, the Rwandan genocide has kicked in from April to July. And so the numbers of orphans who were flowing over the border from Rwanda and Burundi just exponentially increased the number of children landing on her doorstep. And for the first 4 years, she just did everything she could, assuming that it was her job to save as many kids as she could. And there was then another massacre, not unlike the one that she lived through in 93, in a town about 10 miles away from where she was living. And she went to the site of the massacre where, once again, women and children had been killed and the bodies were lying around. And she stood amidst this scene. And I think in some ways, without knowing it, at least knowing it immediately, she just fell apart. She physically, emotionally, mentally, she fell. She lost her voice. She couldn't speak. She went to a doctor thinking she had some kind of ailment. Maybe she'd acquired asthma. And he said, no, you don't have asthma. You've got something much more fundamental going wrong with you. I mean, she had just put herself in circumstances that were untenable, and she was paralyzed, couldn't do anything. So she ended up going to a Carmelite monastery for a month. She did nothing for that month other than read the Bible and pray and cry. She would tell you it was really the first time in 4 years that she'd really allowed herself to cry. The nuns brought her food. She spent a lot of time reading the Bible. And the single thing that she would tell you happened in that month is that she realized that it wasn't her job to save all the children of Burundi. That was God's job. Up to that point, she really had thought it was her job, and it was crushing her. And once she made the mental shift, which again, very much has to do with how she lives her faith, that this is not my job. I'll do what I can, but ultimately, God, this is your job. It's your responsibility. She was able to take all of the weight off of her own shoulders and put it on God, and that changed everything for her.
That's a very useful way of phrasing things. Because there's so much that we want or feel to do that's overwhelming, that is motivated by our faith. But I'm just curious, as you've spent, as you said, over a decade in conversation, in correspondence, what has this done for you and your own faith or relationship to God?
It's a hard question to answer. I mean, so I didn't grow up in the church. I married a Catholic woman along the way and ended up going to a divinity school for a theological degree, even though I wasn't a Christian. One thing led to another. I got surrounded by a bunch of Christian people who pulled me in. So I've never quite known how to think of my own relationship to Christianity and Catholicism in particular, other than that I live with people for whom it matters a lot. I think when I put Maggie in that context, I mean, maybe a good way to put it would be, I've always been one who finds the path to being faithful if I surround myself with people who are, because left to my own devices, I might not last very long. And if you're in the presence of Maggie, and I brought her to classrooms that had a number of atheists in the room. I've seen it over and over again. It doesn't matter who you are or what your faith is. There is something about her being that is so compelling. I think a lot of it has to do with, despite what she's lived through, she's so full of joy. She exudes it. It's like contagious. So when you're in her presence, if you're trying to think about what it means to be a faithful Christian, it somehow feels easier. When I'm with Maggie, I don't doubt that the world is what Maggie believes it to be, because otherwise her life doesn't make any sense. When I'm not with Maggie and I get more and more distant from Maggie, I can become much more of a skeptic. She doesn't allow for that. I think she's been profoundly impactful on me in lots of ways. And I think she helps me continue to imagine what it might be to be a faithful Christian, not by any means trying to be who she is, because that's a bar that I wouldn't want to aim for, but just there's something about her existence that makes it seem like it's really possible that this is the way the world is set up and this is how we're supposed to live.
Gosh, it makes me wonder if there's a list of living people who should in the future be considered for sainthood. Well, if you should be on that list.
I mean, she. I'm not sure how, you know, what a saint is, but I think that she probably fits the category I don't want to put her on a pedestal in one sense. I mean, she's incredibly human. That's the other part of it, right? Like, she's full of flaws, and we'll talk about her mistakes. So part of the sainthood, to the extent that she's living it, is the thorough humanness of who she is, but somehow able to stand in that in the midst of all kinds of trauma and violence and struggles with power, and just maintain this deep sense of what it means to be human at our best.
Now, you went on to form Love's Inventions. Tell me about this.
This is another, I mean, this is also part of the answer of the effect of Maggie on my life. In 2016, a year after Exile, Maggie won the Aurora Prize, which is the inaugural winner of that prize, which is a $1 million award given to remarkable people in the world who've lived through genocide or instances of violence like genocide and have really stood up to show us what it means to be human. So the full title of the prize is the Aurora Prize for Awakening Humanity. When Maggie won that prize, she would tell you that it was for her a sign of what she was now supposed to do in the world, given that she was living in exile. It was no longer about orphans in Burundi. It was most immediately about refugees in Rwanda, many of whom were Burundian. But beyond that, as she won the Aurora Prize a year into exile, she realized that really what God seemed to be calling her to was awakening humanity. I mean, this is not about now Rwanda or Burundi or East Africa, but humanity in general in a world full of violence. She needs to spread the word of peace. So she took the prize to be an indication of that, that this was the new job. The question that lurked for her is how was she going to do that? The first step toward that in any kind of structural way was the creation of a foundation in Belgium called the Foundation Maggie Berenkitse, which was created by a Belgian benefactor of Maggie. And he made the strong case to Maggie that if you're going to actually take your message out to the world, then, you know, you need a platform to do it from. And Maison Shalom, which is dedicated to work in Africa, particularly now in Rwanda, is not the vehicle for that. It's the vehicle for many things, but not for that. And so you need this platform. That was 2021 when Foundation Maggie Berenkitse was created. Maggie came and visited me at Duke in 2022 and immediately started recruiting me to create an entity in the United States that could do the same thing that the entity in Belgium was doing for Europe. And my initial response to that was no, in the sense that I have plenty to do and I don't know that I would know how to do it. It was right after that, literally just days after that, that she received a very serious cancer diagnosis. So there was about a 2-year stall. But then she came back to the U.S. in spring of 24 to the Aurora Prize ceremonies. She comes back every year for the annual ceremony, and it was in Los Angeles. And she invited me out to come because we hadn't seen each other in a couple of years. At that meeting, she had also invited the Belgian, who had started the Belgian Foundation, a guy named Francois. And at the lunch table, I was there with my wife. She just turned to Francois and said, and I just wanted you to meet David because he's the chair of the organization I'm creating in the U.S. to spread my message. At that point, there really was no way to say no. So I, last summer and into this fall, and we're still working on it, I started pulling together the people that I know who I think have the experience to really think about how do you create a new entity that really could do the work of spreading Maggie's message, particularly in the United States. So we have done that now. We've created Love's Inventions. To be honest, this was a real learning lesson for me because one of the remarkable things about Maggie is what she has done in the world from the beginning to now, but certainly from 1993 to now. And part of the answer to that is she has an amazing ability to recruit people to take on work for her. And I realized that I was just one of those people who I got tagged to do it, and she's relentless.
Many thanks to David Toole for speaking with me about Maggie and Love Made Me an Inventor. Find out more about Maison Shalom at maisonshalom.org, MAISONSHALOM. This episode was produced by Heather Bigley. Our production team also includes Heidi Clough, Nick Levitt, and Ocean Marshall. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen and DJ Cromarty. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join me again soon, right here, in Good Faith.
Hi, this is Stephen Cap Perry, and I'd love to recommend one of our BYU Radio family of podcasts for you. It's called The Appleseed. It's filled with stories for you and your family Every episode features really excellent, nationally known storytellers sharing all kinds of folk tales, fairy tales, personal and family stories. It's great to put on and listen to for road trips or bedtime for kids or anytime you want something to get the whole family not only listening, but then those stories generate conversations. And it's so easy to say, hey, do you have a story about this? Or, oh, that reminds me of when grandma said, or whatever it might be. Check out the Appleseed podcast. You'll have fun and you might learn some new stories from your own family members.